And I'd be grateful if you turn back to St. Luke chapter 18. That's page 77 in the second sections, the New Testament sections of the Church Bibles. We're going to be looking at this story under this rather awful title, I'm the Greatest. There's nothing so ugly as spiritual pride, and nothing so beautiful as genuine, unfeigned humility. Here's a man who's gifted, who knows how to get things done, who's a very valuable, much sought-after member of the church, who's held a number of positions of leadership, who's interesting and attractive in many ways. And yet there's something about him, about his manner, and the way he talks about his work, which jars. It's spiritual pride. And here's another person whom normally you'd hardly notice, who's not very intelligent, dependable, but not at all brilliant, who doesn't have any outstanding talents, whose conversation is honestly not very scintillating. And yet there's something very lovely and gentle about them, especially about the way they're constantly praising others. It's humility. Humility pure and simple. And there's nothing so beautiful as genuine Christian humility. Yet most of us find it remarkably difficult to be humble. Most of us are only too conscious of our pride. Jesus, of course, knew what a struggle we have with our inflated opinion of ourselves. And so he told this story, a simple story to expose the ugliness of pride and the beauty, the attractive loveliness of a genuinely humble spirit. We're going to look at both characters in turn. And first, the Pharisee. I've thought hard and long about the Pharisee and scoured the passage to see if we can find what lay at the bottom of his character and his attitudes. And Jesus says the key to his behavior was this. He built his life on self-confidence. You can see it there in verse 9. He told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous. Now, don't get Jesus wrong here. He's not talking about the atheist who's self-confident. He's not talking about the self-made man who sits back and says, I'm all right. I've got a good job, a house, a car, a wife and family. I don't need God. I'm okay as I am. That's certainly self-confidence. But it's not the kind Jesus is talking about here. This Pharisee was very religious. He went to the temple regularly to pray. He was a godly man. In our terms, he was a Christian. He was concerned about being morally faultless, about being righteous. But, verse 9, he was trusting in himself that he was righteous. A telltale symptom of how he was building his whole life on self-confidence. Because you see, all of us have to build our life on something. All of us have to find something which will give us value and significance. Only God meant us to build our life on Christ. He never intended us to build it on self-confidence. But many, many of us, for all our Christian confession, are doing just that. Many of us are constantly bolstering up our opinion of ourselves because we feel if that goes, we shall have nothing. And in the case of the Pharisee, this whole approach had three rather sad results. First, He was always comparing himself with others. He takes up his stand to pray, and in verse 11, these are the first words that come to his lips. God, I thank thee that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers. The first thing he does is to compare himself with others. And look how he immediately picks on their bad points. He hasn't a kind word to say for them. He calls them extortioners, unjust, adulterers. Why? Well, he has to, you see. His whole life is built on self-confidence. And the only way to keep that going is constantly to convince himself how much better he is than everyone else. And so a natural result of relying on yourself is that you begin to despise others. Jesus says as much in verse 9. He told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despise others. And not just others in general, but each individual as well. The Pharisee is praying. As he does so, his eye wanders, and he catches sight of this tax collector, whom he brings into his prayer. Listen, verse 11. God, I thank thee that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. Again, his first reaction is to compare himself with the other man. Yes, each individual has to be assessed, his bad points, his weaknesses drawn out, anything to show that he's not as good as me. You say it's exaggerated. No one could think like that. Couldn't they? You're in a Bible study or fellowship group, and everyone's always thought of you as one of the leading lights. But now you come back from holiday and you're greeted with this news. You know so-and-so joined the group a few months back. Well, he led the Bible study on Tuesday, marvelously. He did it so well, we asked him to lead it again next time. And you think, We'll see about that. So next Bible study, you're there, watching the whole proceedings with an eagle eye, looking out for faults. So that at the end of the evening, you say to yourself, I don't see he's all that brilliant. He let us wander off the point a number of times. Or you go to another church, one that's cracked up a lot, that everyone's enthusing about, and you begin to pick faults. Not as full as we are anyway. And the music's certainly not as good. If you never reacted like that, it's one of the signs of a life that's built on self-confidence. Another sign in the Pharisee's case is that he was always dwelling on the sacrifices he made. He puffs himself up, verse 12. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. Now, those things were quite unnecessary. The Old Testament law said you only need fast once a year on the Day of Atonement. But that wasn't good enough for the Pharisees. They fasted twice a week. And then the law only said certain things had to be tithed. The corn from your fields, your cattle, and so on. You didn't have to tithe meat bought at the market. You could assume that had been tithed already. But our Pharisee tithed it again. And he enjoyed reminding himself of it. He enjoyed dwelling on these sacrifices. It made him feel so good. It boosted his self-esteem, his self-confidence so much. And he remembered it again with a smile of satisfaction as he prayed in the temple. Of course, today we make different sacrifices, but we still love to dwell on them. How many times do you hear this kind of conversation in Christian circles? Someone asks, how are you? And you answer, well, I'm desperately busy. There's so much on. We're under real pressure at the moment, what with the fellowship group and the Sunday school and Jane who's ill. And it all means I give a tremendous amount of time and energy to other people and in Christian involvement. I make big sacrifices for my Christian faith. And I hope you notice the bags under my eyes. So that if someone says, you do look tired, we almost take it as a compliment. Oh, do I, we say, feigning surprise. And we swell with pride. And it's all a sign that we're building our lives on self-confidence. That we feel if I can't prove I'm valuable, if I can't somehow show I'm really pulling my weight, what have I left? But the third sign in the Pharisee's life was the saddest of all. He was never really in touch with God. Verse 11. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself. Now, probably the literal meaning is this. He prayed silently. He prayed to himself, not aloud, as the Jews often pray. But it seems pretty likely that Jesus meant this to be a deliberate pun, that the Pharisee was praying with himself in another sense, because this wasn't real prayer. He wasn't really in touch with God at all. He was just talking to himself. And that becomes obvious when you look more closely at what he said in verse 11. He begins all right, God, I thank thee. But then he goes on to think about himself, to congratulate himself, to concentrate exclusively on himself. And he's so taken up with himself that quite clearly there is no real communication with God at all. It's the saddest effect of spiritual pride. We become so concerned with ourselves to prove that we're just as good as others. In fact, all in all, we're better. So concerned to dwell on the good we do that we haven't really faced up to the fact that our spiritual lives are cold and dead and have been for some months or even years. And often when we're most zealously persuading ourselves that we've many good points and that we have an important and valuable part to play, that is the precise moment when our spiritual lives are actually at their deadest. It's a further sad sign of building one's life on self-confidence. But let's now turn from the Pharisee to the other character in the story, to the tax collector. And let's ask again, what's at the bottom of his character, his attitudes? Well, Jesus makes it quite clear that the key to his life is this. He was desperately aware of his need. To use his own words, he knew he was a sinner, and he needed God's mercy. In other words, he saw his guilt. According to verse 13, he beat his breast as he prayed. And by that gesture, he was saying, I know it's me. It's I who've done it. I who've sinned. It comes from here, from my heart, from inside. And even today, the Roman Catholics repeat this gesture. They beat their breasts as they confess and say, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea grande culpa. My guilt, my guilt, my great guilt. And so the tax collector saw very clearly that he was guilty. He wasn't trying to blame any blemishes in his character on society or the Roman state or an unhappy home background. Of course, these things may have made matters worse, but he was guilty. He saw that very clearly. And he not only saw his guilt, He felt his guilt as well. Verse 13 says he was standing far off, not daring to come too close to God. It says he wouldn't even lift up his eyes to heaven. And that was the attitude in which he prayed. These weren't idly repeated words about having erred and strayed from thy ways like lost sheep. No, he felt it deeply. He was guilty, and he needed God's mercy. And that awareness in the Bible's eyes is very healthy. Of course, there can be an unhealthy awareness of guilt, a kind of morbid picking at one's spiritual scabs, wallowing in one's own uselessness and sin. But the Bible is absolutely categorical that it is healthy to have a clear understanding and, yes, a feeling of our guilt, provided we also understand something of God's mercy. So if you come here tonight very conscious of having failed this week, very aware of how often you've let God down, of how far you've got to go as a Christian, rather depressed by your sin, that's good. Because, says our story, you're in just the right situation to receive God's mercy and forgiveness. It's only the person who sees himself as a sinner and feels it deeply who can know the freedom Christ brings. And this desperate awareness of his need had two consequences in the tax collector's life. First, he asked for help. He prayed at the end of verse 13, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." I wonder if you noticed that the Pharisee asked for nothing. He didn't feel he needed anything. And so he just gave thanks, or pretended to. But the truly humble man asked for help. Now I find that fascinating, because we live in an age when Christians tell us we must praise and worship more. Speaking for myself, I agree with them. The praise in my own prayer life is pathetic, threadbare, and unworthy. But don't let's go overboard. Don't let's start despising the prayer which asks God for things by calling it a shopping list or purely self-centered. On the contrary, it is a sign that we are aware of our need, and as such, it is a step on the road to humility. The truly humble man will always be asking for help from God. And the second consequence I notice in the tax collector is that he respected others. You see, the tax collector also compared himself with others. And this, verse 13, is what he said. "God, be merciful to me, the sinner." That's what it says literally. "God, be merciful to me, the sinner." He was so aware of his guilt that he seemed to himself the great sinner in the world. And so he could look others in the face and see their good points. He could respect them. How? What made the difference? Well, simply this. He wasn't building his life on self-confidence, on keeping up with the spiritual Joneses. He was building his life on the mercy of God. God's mercy to him, the sinner. That was what brought him forgiveness and acceptance and freedom. And the message is very clear. While we are constantly having to boost our own ego, doing everything to establish our own goodness and importance, we will always be looking down on others. Always. And we can only really start respecting them when we give up any claim to being better than the rest, and in humility start looking upon ourselves as the sinner. And that's the end of the story, or almost. In fact, it has a little sting in its tail. Look at it there in verse 14. "I tell you," says Jesus, "this man went down to his house justified rather than the other." Ironic, really. The man who went up so aware of his need, so very conscious that he was a sinner, that was the man who came home justified or forgiven, with his slate wiped clean. And incidentally, let me step aside for a moment and make one point. People have been saying for years that Christianity, as we know it, was an invention of St. Paul. That he took the simple moral teaching of Jesus and made it into a whole theological system. All this business of justification by faith and so on, that doesn't sound like Jesus at all. And yet here is Jesus using that very phrase. He says the tax collector was justified, that's the word he uses. Not so very different from Paul after all. But that's by the by. The real point is this. The man who was so conscious of his guilt, that man was forgiven. But the man who went up so confident that he was righteous, so sure God was pleased with him, that man returned home unjustified. That man went out of the temple unforgiven. He left still in his sins. Quite a frightening thought. And then Jesus adds a moral, directly for his listeners. It comes at the end of verse 14. "Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted." And I want to close by saying briefly what that means for us. There are some here, just like that first man, religious, moral, upright, brought up as churchgoers all their lives. And you've been taught, at least that's what you've gathered, that if you live a decent life and do your best to do your duty by God and your neighbor, that's all God requires. You'll be quite all right. Let me say it gently. This parable was spoken directly to counter that attitude. It's only when you see you're a sinner needing God that God can accept you. And maybe for the first time tonight, you need to get down before God and say humbly and from your heart, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." And for the first time to be completely cleansed and forgiven. But there are many others here who came to God as a sinner some time ago, and who are only too painfully aware, nevertheless, of how spiritual pride creeps back in, of how easily we build our lives on ourselves. And you know you need to humble yourselves, but you ask, how? How can I do it? Pride seems so strong. And the answer is constantly to go back to your need, constantly to remind yourself of the guilt which God in his mercy has wiped away, constantly to recognize those very real faults which he has forgiven, No man finds it easy to bow his proud head. But the man who's bowed it once to Christ should find it easier to bow it every day. And so to know the glorious freedom of standing justified, forgiven before God. Let's pray. Father, pride, ugly pride, poisons our lives daily. And we confess that to our other sins of pride, pride in our achievements, pride in our nationality, we have added the ugliest sort of all, the pride in our spiritual standing. Thank you that you offer forgiveness, even to us proud sinners. And help us, day by day, so to humble ourselves under your mighty hand, that we may know the joy of freedom from guilt in humility. Amen.